Universität Hamburg.
Those who refuse to listen to dragons are probably doomed to spend their lives acting out the nightmares of politicians. This is a quote taken from Ursula Le Guin's fantasy-like poetry, Speaks the Language of the Night. It's also at the heart of my interest in the rise of fantasy that began with the youth movements of the late 1960s. They were protesting the atomic bomb, Vietnam, the economical exploitation of natural resources, and they were united in a disillusionment with traditional systems of belief, be they political or religious. A new focus for the frustrated hopes and dreams soon came along in 1965 with the unauthorized mass market edition of J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings and the start of Linklater's Ballantine adult fantasy series that published reprints of classics and new talents like Peter S. Beagle, new at the time that is. Fantasy was quickly established as a countercultural phenomenon from its roots on the fringes of marketability and the academic literary canon. 40 years later, The Lord of the Rings has shed both its subcultural creation and its countercultural adoption. It has transcended media boundaries into animated films, role-playing games, and computer games. There have also been three blockbuster films, together grossing almost $3 billion. And The Return of the King in 2003 is still the highest-grossing fantasy film ever. The films also sparked mass interest in fantasy, so the sales of books and other media of the genre have soared since then. But the question remains, what might be possible reasons for this enormous cultural impact of fantasy after its humble start, with a readership numbering only a few thousand throughout the world in the late 1950s, according to Michael Moorcock? I'd like to find possible answers to that on two levels. First of all, the level of the definition and development of fantasy, asking the question, what is it? And secondly, on the level of the functions of fantasy, asking the question, what does it do on a metaphysical, psychological, and sociocultural level? So before we speak about fantasy, we also have to speak about the term itself. So what's in the name? The word itself originates in the Greek fantasia, which means a making visible, according to Prickett. In its earlier English use, it was connected to spectral apparitions and phantoms, and it was not until Chaucer's time, which, for those of you who are not in English studies, this late 14th century, that we see a neutral attribution to the unreal as a mental image of something that does not exist. In Shakespeare's time, and I'm not giving you the time here, there were connotations of the unhealthy and immature that were connected with fantasy. And this remained intact until the 18th century, so we always have this association with madmen and children when people speak of fantasy at the time. It was not until the Romantics reclaimed and reappropriated the word in their struggle for autonomy of the artistic creation beyond mimesis that it came to mean a mental image or a daydream. And it took until 1949, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, that we see fantasy meaning a genre of literary composition, so fairly late actually. Defining fantasy has always been a tricky business. Prickett builds his definition on the development of the term. So for him, fantasy means the making, that's a quote, the making visible of something that does not exist, unquote. Tolkien focuses in his definition on his concept of the sub-creation, quote, the making and glimpsing of other worlds, unquote, together with the strangeness and wonder that is derived from the images created. Colin Mandlove then tried to bring all these earlier definitions together, and he formed a very detailed and comprehensive definition himself as, quote, a fiction evoking wonder and containing a substantial and irreducible element of the supernatural or impossible worlds, beings, or objects. What I find most interesting in this attempt of defining fantasy is Atterbury's approach, because he differentiates between different kinds of fantasy. So for him, fantasy can be the formulaic fantasy that we all know, the mass market, popular, escapist entertainment, and commercial product that relies on consistency and predictability. And on the other hand of the spectrum, Atterbury locates fantasy as a mode, a sophisticated, self-reflexive, and/or subversive investigation into the construction of all meaning and reality. In between these two extremes, Atterbury then puts the genre of fantasy. So that will be all representations, mixing elements of both extremes according to the historical and sociocultural contexts. Interesting about Atterbury's attempt is also that we find this basic conflict between creative freedom and conventions that is inherent to all making of meaning within the definition of fantasy itself. And it's also a mythological topos that we find here, the eternal struggle between chaos and order, that is then formally mirrored in fantasy in our rational and secular societies. Wolf takes up Tolkien's ideas of secondary belief, that is, belief created from and targeted at secondary worlds, that is used to overcome what in Tolkien's reading is the broken reading experience of Coleridge's willing suspension of disbelief. According to Wolf, a successful reading of fantasy is only possible if you integrate the ideas presented with the effective qualities of fantasy. This then creates what he calls deep belief. The secondary world becomes, quote, an analog of inner experience virtually as valid as events of the real world, unquote. So based on these previous definitions, I will come to an attempt of my own definition, uniting all of these ideas. Fantasy would then be a, quote, myself, genre not only of literature, constantly oscillating between open mode and static formula that establishes impossible secondary worlds and from these creates secondary deep belief to inspire affective reactions to the ideas presented in the reader-viewer. Speaking about the development of fantasy, you always have to ask yourself the question, what are the sources of the materials that are used? Obviously, you would have to go back to mythological and epic literature, as well as the medieval romances that inform the motifs and structures like the archetypal heroes, the magical items, the epic quest, harking back to Campbell's Hero's Journey. But there's a big difference between myth and fantasy. This is what Martin calls the Sitz im Leben, so the historical, textual, and sociocultural context of its production and reception. Whereas myth is evoking primary belief, frequently also in connection with institutionalized religion, for social and collective functions, fantasy is evoking secondary belief for more introspective and private functions. This can be connected back nicely to the beginnings of the genre, associated with a romantic turn away from reason and the dictates of mimesis and objective truth towards imagination and the fantastic in the early 19th century. It was British authors who first established a referential framework for the genre that we now call fantasy, using the creative power of the mode of fantasy. George MacDonald's Fantasties of 1858 or Lilith of 1895 both create secondary worlds that appear to be more real than the primary world we live in. George MacDonald also established the traditions of the fantasy heroes that we all know now. William Morris, with The Well at the World's End of 1896, is called the father of fantasy by Nagel, as he creates, according to Nagel, the first unique and comprehensive secondary world, the distinctive register and style of fantasy, as well as the epic quest form. The third in this triad at the beginning of British fantasy is Lord Dunsany, with his King of Elfland's Daughter of 1924, who also creates a complex secondary world, and in turn, the naming conventions that we find so familiar now in most of the fantasy that we read. In a second step, it was US authors who created the subgenre of sword and sorcery, or heroic fantasy. So the focus was more on adventurous battles and mystical magic. These stories were published in pulp magazines, so the pendulum now swings towards the more formulaic and the entertainment aspect of fantasy. Robert E. Howard's Conan of 1932 is the genre prototype, but there are others like Fritz Lieber's Swords of Lankhmar of 1939 or Paul Anderson's novel The Broken Sword of 1954, which again connects the genre nicely back to its roots in epic and historical literature. Unavoidable then comes Tolkien, who is always credited with establishing the genre conventions, so I'm not doing that again. He turned the creative process upside down, which is very interesting. So he first created this extremely detailed secondary world, and then from the world he created his stories. I mean, we're all familiar with The Hobbit, 1937, or The Lord of the Rings, 1954-55, but there are a couple of other stories. So what is then what makes Tolkienian fantasy? On a level of content, we have this immensely detailed secondary world that is a fully established secondary reality. On a level of structure, Tolkien goes for a comic structure, but comic not like ha-ha funny, but comic in that sense that order is restored at the end of the hero's journey. And this is exactly where the escapist readings of Tolkien click with the text. On a level of the reader response, Tolkien aimed for consolation and cathartic wonder. And when we talk about the metaphysics of Tolkienian fantasy, this is mostly about the recovery of the child's sense of wonder and the re-enchantment of the world versus an ideology of appropriation that Tolkien saw rampant in the early to mid-20th century when he wrote that text. All of the later authors are then obviously always constructed in reaction to Tolkien, either directly or indirectly. So we have Michael Moorcock's Elric Saga, begun in 1961, that many see as a conscious break with Tolkienian conventions. He gives us a doomed anti-hero who destroys everything and everyone he loves in his quest. This refusal of consolation then reinforces the role of the individual in the narrative and also the emotional impact of the stories. Ursula Le Guin's Earthsea series, begun in 1968, replaces the mythical and epic scope with a private and psychological one. So she basically writes a fantasy Bildungsroman, which I was told is also the English word, with her internalization of the hero's journey. Peter S. Beagle, with The Last Unicorn, 1968, is a playful and ironic rewriting of the genre conventions, with stock characters violating reader expectations and intentional anachronisms, fracturing the illusion of the secondary world. And obviously, in the 1970s and 80s, we had feminist authors rewriting the traditionally underdeveloped female characters and empowering them in texts such as Patricia McKillop's Riddlemaster of Head trilogy, 76, 79, sorry, or Marion Seymour Bradley, most famously for Mr. Vavilon, 1983. What is interesting about this process, however, is that the genre itself seems to be a product of a still ongoing, constant negotiation between the different aspects of, that are used to define fantasy itself. So, talking about the functions of fantasy now, again, both myth and fantasy speak to us about the conditio humana, but there is a crucial difference. Myth expects an unreflected, collective, and dogmatic primary belief, creating a community of passive objects to authorial and discursive power. Fantasy calls for a reflected, individual, and negotiated secondary belief, creating a community of active subjects, using discursive power to co-create meaning. This obviously has a huge impact on the functions of fantasy. On a metaphysical level, we speak about the question of truth, capital T that is. So after the collapse of primary belief due to enlightenment, nature was constructed as conquered and possessed. This in turn led to a sense of alienation from the self, the other, and nature. Together with this feeling of the impossibility of truth, as we recognize that the human mind can only indirectly represent reality, whatever that may be, and we need mediation through perception and conceptualization, and then, secondly, also through representation. Fantasy being the child of the romantic turn, all mimesis in truth is inherently seen as problematic, but meaning is not impossible to it. Tapping into the power of myth and archetype is used to give meaning and effective relevance to the text of fantasy, while at the same time breaking these archetypes through the co-creative process, as there can be no consensus on the true nature of the secondary world. This creates a negotiated middle ground, seeking answers beyond dogma and at the same time not falling into the abnegation of all meaning and thus silence. This was maybe what appealed to the revolutionary generation of the late 1960s, on their private search for universal, deeper meaning in a shared but individual rebellion. The refusal of monological ideology, the preference for plurilogical... It's a bit early and it's Sunday, sorry. And I have a headache. The preference for plurilogical openness and the longing for the power of meaning. Talking about the psychological function of fantasy, we're talking about the individual. So fantasy is the language of the inner self, according to Le Guin. The subconscious and association are dominant creative instances, not the conscious and the paradigm. It's all about symbolic representation that prevents objective reference. Fantasy, thus, is highly subjective, reinstating the human factor and the individual. In a very ironic formulation, Atterbury attests that, quote, fantasy is in a sense mimetic, for it depicts the associational processes of the unconscious, unquote. Freedom of fantasy creates anxiety also through the constant questioning of the self and the structures around us. So existential angst and latent autoaggression also echo the feelings of the young generation of the 1960s. The power of meaning-making was lost to them in traditional forms of belief and living, but there was a promise for recovery and re-enchantment in fantasy. Fantasy was also perceived as akin to altered states of consciousness. So these authors became quasi-spiritual guides on the way to new impressions and sensations. And the body and sexuality became central to renegotiations in areas of conflict, of heroic fantasy, and especially feminist fantasy. This anxiety also, according to Le Guin, results from the socially expected repression of the Jungian shadow in all of us. So the thus weakened personalities fall into what she calls empty forms, this being the ideologies, religions, and all the other meta-narratives that provide the illusions of security. And I hope I'm not stepping on anyone's toes here when I say that. Fantasy, to Le Guin, is the literature of emancipation, harking back to the topos of coming of age. It's all about redefining the shadow as the guardian of the threshold towards the subconscious and the source of all creative power. It's about confronting and accepting the shadow to form a mature self that is able to live Keats's negative capability and thus true community. But theory, to Le Guin, is not enough. She needs visceral and instinctual understanding through art, and thus she creates A Wizard of Earthsea in 1968, which is the story of an individual's return to wholeness through self-knowledge, accepting his shadow as part of himself in a quasi-mythological scene. When we talk about the sociocultural functions of society, we need to find answers to the question, why did fantasy explode into the public awareness exactly then and there? Talking about the time, postmodernism, like modernism, reacts to the meta-narratives of the 19th century, but it does not provide coherent and ordered responses. It refuses binary choice and shows a preference for ambiguity. It paradoxically deconstructs and yearns for the stability of what Olsen calls the transcendental signified. And building on this idea, Olsen then claims that postmodernism can be seen as a symptom of a culture in crisis, although the negative connotation that we usually have with crisis is not appropriate here. This is more a state of change, rapid change. To him, quote, postmodern art faces the problem of responding to a situation that is literally fantastic. No wonder then that fantasy becomes the vehicle for the postmodern consciousness. The fantastic becomes the realism our culture understands, unquote. Talking about the space of the emergence of fantasy, U.S. society has always been especially fond of fantasy. That might go back to the collective experience of the frontier and the wildness that is frequently identified as a core concept behind motifs in U.S. literature. The American dream, according to Thompson, is all about denying the fall and creating a place of total freedom. Yet the negative reaction the system showed to fantasy speaks against this idea. So fantasy was not found in public libraries in the beginning, it was not appreciated by academics, it was relegated to escapist entertainment. This led to Le Guin's famous question, why are Americans afraid of dragons? For her, this moralistic censorship that fantasy faced in the beginning was not a sign of strength of the system, but of fear. So the white, male, profit-minded, heterosexual Puritans rejected the genre because reading for pleasure was sin to them. Creating a fictional world does not create immediate profit, and fiction and imagination in itself were seen as unmanly. Thus they were, quote, afraid of dragons because they are afraid of freedom, unquote. This is either an ironic perversion of the American dream as constructed by Thompson and others, perpetuated by exactly the group that most fervently propagated it, or, in Le Guin's reading, this could also be about the fears of this group's own repressed desires. So is fantasy then, and this is my conclusion, so thank you, is fantasy then the nightmare of politicians? Possible reasons for the cultural impact of fantasy could be found on the level of definitions and development, like this indeterminacy and openness of the genre, the refusal of mimesis and dogma, constantly renegotiating between freedom and convention, and at the same time the promise of deeper meaning while breaking the illusion of universal and objective truth. On the level of the functions of fantasy, you could construct the reading of the genre as a powerful tool to create self-aware, self-sufficient, and active subjects out of acts of emancipation, while at the same time it lends itself nicely as a screen for the projection of repressed desires, be they escapist in nature, about childlike wish fulfillment, or on the other hand, about aggressive refusal of the genre itself. What is for me most interesting, though, is that fantasy seems to be the natural, whatever that may be in that context, expression of the postmodern individual, searching for truth and at the same time being unwilling to find it. But there are two caveats I'd like to end on. First of all, The openness and subjective quality of fantasy might have been the exact reason why the forces controlling discourse at the time allowed fantasy to become the focus of the countercultural movement. Because the collective and revolutionary impulse to enforce social change in a primary reality would be fractured and directed towards a secondary reality or secondary creation. Secondly, the enormous financial success of fantasy at the turn of the millennium seems to be proof that the powers that be have learned how to abuse the affective power of fantasy for profit. So we have the implicit self-censorship that we see in fantasy authors to boost sales on a mass market. And what we end up with is the empty, sellable, and mass-produced commodity that we all hate. So those formerly afraid of dragons now seem to be breeding them for profit. Experienced readers of fantasy know that dragons are amongst the oldest and wisest creatures there are. So you would naturally go and listen to them on your quest to avoid living the nightmares of politicians. But experienced readers of fantasy also knows that dragons never say anything innocently and always have plans of their own. Thank you.